Good morning, everybody. This is Robin Ayu from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another episode. Welcome to another recording. With this episode, I think we're recording 235, episode 235. So welcome back. Good to have you with us. I am your host, and today's conversation is one I have genuinely been looking forward to because my guest brings perspective on a different perspective. The perspective that we're looking for that we normally don't get to have that perspective is the buyer's perspective. We normally talk about how technically we do a translation, how technology drives translation, how AI impact the localization industry. But this is a little different. And I'll let Wada Fahil introduce herself in a second. But just to give you a little bit of a perspective on Wada today is that she worked at Xerox. She also worked at Harley Davidson. And she also worked at Zendesk. She built basically localization functions, whatever she ended up with, from the ground up. So she got a firsthand experience and front row seat to how do you put together a localization department from the buyer's perspective, from the enterprise perspective. And how do we use localization vendors and technology and all the other tools that comes along with that? It's very, very valuable perspective. I can't wait to dig into the conversation. And also my guest, Wada Osiwell, she is a founder of a new or been around for a while, Localverse, and where she consults and help companies on the best practices when it comes to localization deployment and localization practices in general. So we'll get into that as well. We'll get into the details of the service that I would offer and for what the expertise and the experience she brings. One more mention, Wada and I, we come from the same country. She's Lebanese also, and I'm also, as I've told you a million times on this podcast, I am originally from Lebanon as well, and I'm very happy to speak to another Lebanese person on this podcast. I don't get that option often, but it's always a treat to connect with somebody who's originally from my home country, where half of my heart's still there. So welcome to the channel, Wada. Appreciate it.
The very generous introduction, Robin. I'll try to live up to 70% of.
I'm sure you'll bypass the 70%. I've got no doubt you're going to hit a 200% on this one. So I appreciate. Now I'm speaking like Lebanese now. You see that? I'm over exaggerating things now. That's the notion of who we are, I guess. I really appreciate being with me. And if you don't mind, now, like the first question, let's launch into it. Is the story question, the origin question? What got you here? For the audience who don't know you, never met you before, where have you been and what got you to where you are right now?
Sure. So like many people in localization, including you and I probably, I did not choose it intentionally, right? My background is in international business. I started my career in quality management at an Italian company called Cartier Emiliani Fabriano. I was working with ISO 9001 standards. And one day my boss asked me to find a way to translate SOPs or standard operating procedures and non-conformity reports into various languages for Europe. I thought, okay, I'm resourceful. But that assignment introduced me to certified translation companies and eventually to the broader world of localization, if you will. Later, I moved to the States in the early 2000s for graduate studies. And I quickly realized there was a much larger market for this work. By then, localization felt almost second nature to me. I consider myself fortunate to have held leadership roles with iconic brands like Xerox, Harley Davidson, and Zendesk before transitioning to full-time consulting. As you know, building or leading loc is part strategy, part operations, and part diplomacy. You have to create structure, evolve teams, nurture stakeholders, prove value, and build trust all at once. So that's, in a nutshell, my story.
That's how you got here, right?
Yeah.
Now, I know you mentioned it earlier. Nobody, wake up at the age of whatever, graduating from school or got your first job and dream about running a localization practice of any sort. You're right. I got into it by accident. And, I've said this before on this channel, maybe boring, but I got on a plane from Washington and somebody sat beside me a two-hour flight later, I ended up working in an industry I didn't know existed. There you go. Here we are right now, 26 years later. You've built localization functions from zero, and you know that's admirable. At the time when you built it, probably, I'm assuming, we did not have the tools we have now. We did not have the propagation of many vendors or many options or many things to choose from, processes, etc. So when you walk into a company on day one and there's nothing, for those who are out there right now, and these things are still happening now, believe it or not, like, yeah, you know, you can buy these things, but somebody right now is thinking, okay, I'm dealing with a vendor, probably I want to build something internally, or I don't have anything in place, I want to build something internally. No teams, no tools, no processes. Where do you actually start?
Actually, it's easier to start from scratch than joining a pre-established team, because I was fortunate at Harley Davidson. When I joined the organization, there was executive sponsorship for localization, and it was driven by compliance needs. But taking the job meant also relocating. We were expecting our second child at the time, but they made me an offer I could not decline, and I jumped. And honestly, it turned out to be one of the defining career decisions for me. I spent close to a decade at Harley Davidson building the localization capability from the ground up and expanding it across four global markets. And that experience stretched me in every possible way. Not only because we're building from scratch, but you're talking about a company with more than 120 years of legacy, hierarchy, brand prestige, and heritage. I was the only woman with an accent across three headquarters building, Robin. And most of the workforce was tattooed head to toe, owned at least one bike, and had the deeply held belief about how a motorcycle should sound. My accent was honestly the easier thing to explain. But still, we built a strong capability from scratch because I had executive sponsorship and I was able to build relationships with the teams around the organization. I spent a lot of time running environmental scans and understanding my audience, their pain points, and aligning localization solutions to their pain points. And even with that, you know, I worked with some of the best people I've ever met in manufacturing. But I think what gets you through building from scratch, one, you want to have executive sponsorship because that's going to drive your budget. But nothing is guaranteed. If you don't prove yourself on the job, if you don't demonstrate that this multi-million dollar budget is going to return, then trust starts eroding. And I believe I mapped out the lay of the land very well in terms of understanding the sphere of influence vertically and horizontally, and how to work and achieve small wins, if you will, leading to a long-term compounding effect, leading to success stories that earn trust and rapport. And after almost a decade, we were expanded across 150 markets and the entire organization in a centralized environment.
Centralized environment, that's pretty impressive. Mm-hmm. Now, the people are asking right now, or wondering, did you own a Harley? Did you have a Harley? Did you drive one?
I did. They take you under your wing. So at the beginning, you end up joining a HOG group, Harley Davidson owner group, and you get your license and you join a group. You have the Thursday night bike, but it's a short season here in Wisconsin. So it's between May and October. But it's also a two-wheel vehicle without airbags. So you're going to have your accident. And they tell you that actually during the course. And I had mine, but it was a social thing for me. It was a matter of belonging to the team and to the ladies around me. And I enjoyed that part. But then I had to make the call, right? I have two children and I could not afford getting disabled at a young age. So I tabled it, but I did have a bike and I did have, I enjoyed many rides.
Absolutely. There's a lot of motorcycle fans on the podcast. I know one of them is a teacher. Of you know, driving motorcycles. I never been on one, to be honest with you, and I don't know if I want to be on one. I never crossed my mind. Like, it never excited me to be on a motorcycle. I don't know why a lot of people get so attracted to that. But the point that you're making is, in order for us to understand how to put localization together, we at least need to sample what are we localizing. You know, be it a product, a software, a food product, whatever it is, you got to feel it. You got to be part of that fabric of it, if you will. From an engineering point of view, from a building point of view, from a maintenance point of view, it all flows together into one localized story. If you don't mind, Wada, what did you have to unlearn between the first time, in between when you first time built a function to the last time you built a function? I'm sure there's some learnings in there. What worked and what did not work? What did you not want to repeat the next time you did this?
Plenty of learning. This is an excellent question. And I'm still learning, even during consulting, believe it or not, even after 2 decades at localization.
Oh, it never stops, right?
Learning never ends, never stops. When I moved into tech with Zendesk, that was right around COVID. And that was completely a different universe. 80% of the workforce was very young. Slack was the default communication channel. And email was considered retro. The pace was very different. And I came from a manufacturing environment in the Midwest where it was all about, credibility and accountability, and it mattered more than titles. And now I have to suddenly adopt this laid-back approach. But I joined an established team, unlike with Harley, where I had the opportunity to build from scratch. And people think that an established team is an easier thing to guide or to lead or to upskill. It's not, because you have to walk a fine line. You're not building from zero. So you are repositioning a function from something perceived as operational support to something that requires a rooftop business impact. The cultures were completely different. So I had to spend some time understanding the lay of the land, tons of meetings, understanding what was working, what was not working. Because there are things that you want to keep, there are things that you want to kill, and there are things that you need to overhaul. But you asked also about what stayed the same. I would say my leadership philosophy did not change in terms of building trust, understanding the business, engaging stakeholders in their own language, and most importantly, coaching the team to do the same. The vendor buildup or the vendor setup was totally different for Zendesk. I realized that I needed a different type of setup from a technology perspective and also from a vendor perspective and outreach. So the idea that it could be a cookie cutter approach when you join an organization and set up team, set up vendor, set up tech is not true. Each company is unique with it in its environment, its culture, its requirements, assessing the content, the pace, the launches. For example, at Harley, we had one model year launch, and that was a huge launch. You work all year to prepare for it. You had leverage, you had time. When I moved to Zendesk, we launched every quarter. So I had to develop bias towards time. And that changed my philosophy a little bit. The vendors I worked with did not have the luxury of time. So I needed to work with them to help them be ready for any launch. So again, different pace, different culture, but the values, the leadership values stay the same.
I hit the mute button by accident. I'm sorry, guys.
I was going to say no worries.
It happens to everybody, to the best of us, including me. And I love that coffee, by the way. That coffee is my perfect one.
Yeah, Lebanese coffee.
Lebanese coffee.
Nothing beats it.
For the audience, if you have some nights where you need a bit of stay up a little bit or a lot, just have one of those. And you know what I'm talking about. It beats a hell of an espresso, let me tell you that.
Absolutely.
Well, here's my pitch for the Lebanese coffee now. One of the things is that you brought up, which is very valid, is there are in anything, specifically in what you've done across multiple companies, there are things that stays the same and there are things that changes. Every company's got its own culture, it's got its own product, it's got its own clientele or the market that they're going after. But there are, fundamentally, there is a content that needs to be localized. Now, there are many things that goes along with that. One of the conversations that takes place, and I'd love to take your opinion on this one, is everybody in the language industry, at least on the LSP side, we say, localization is left till the last piece of the puzzle. And, it's an afterthought. That's what they call it. But, for many people, like if you're a product manager or if you're a program manager or if you're in charge of putting something together, you're under a lot of pressure to deliver something. And definitely, perhaps localization is maybe in the last piece on, that's at least the impression from the outside, is the last piece on your schedule. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you've seen that. But there is a big effort in the industry to change that by educating the customer, by making sure that we put localization on the project map, not after the project map is finished. Has there been any experience with that? What's your opinion on this?
In terms of nurturing the stakeholders?
Yeah.
Plenty of experience, plenty of stories. And I think we need a full session.
Full session with that one?
A full session just to cover the stories of nurturing. Now, I think the challenge with localization in general, the perception is that localization is an afterthought and we're not getting enough attention. We're not being considered as part of the full life cycle of the project. All valid. This is a legitimate concern. I've lived through it on large campaigns and even technical content or compliance content. But there's also a challenge in the mentality at the industry level. We're so focused on making people understand what we do instead of spending the time listening to their pain points, understanding their challenges, and aligning our solutions to these challenges.
Very true.
That's not just a vendor side situation. It's also internal localization team type of a mindset and mentality. I can't tell you how many times I sat with vendors and it was a one-way conversation explaining how great the solution was, how unique the offering was, how the native speakers reside in their country of origin, without allowing the client to tell their story. And I think the biggest challenge is when you're also working with a vendor who did not do a due diligence. So they show up evangelizing, educating you on their platform instead of doing the due diligence, understanding who you are and as a client, and tell a story that you could relate to as a client. So I do not want to discount the fact that, yes, localization is overlooked, but we also own part of the responsibility as vendors and as an industry in terms of not making enough effort to understand the audience, read the room, and tell a compelling story. Now, internally, I spent most of my career, believe it or not, coaching my team members on how to read a room and listen and understand an audience before responding. If you walk into a CMO organization meeting or a marketing room and you're armed with LQA and fuzzy matches, you're going to lose.
Sure.
We've never leveraged localization language during marketing meetings. We led with email click-throughs, traffic to website, etc.
If
you're entering a compliance meeting, you're leading with governance, due diligence, fines in certain market, and how localization eliminate the fines, because sometimes you work by elimination. If you have a full year without legal fines in Canada, for example, you're doing great. So I think this is the opportunity that is overlooked a lot more than evangelizing and educating and trying to force ourselves on a full roadmap or a full life cycle of a project.
No, look, I mean, I've been critical of our industry quite a bit. And for those of you who are familiar with me and you've seen some of my posts on LinkedIn, you'll know what I'm talking about. I've seen some horror stories that, you know, any other industry, nobody would get away with it. Where a supplier is telling the customer, no, that's not how you do it. That's how we tell you how you do it. And yeah, I get that you are an expert at translation, but the customer is still the customer. And you need to understand the requirements of the customer, deliver customized solution based on the customer requirements. And listening is a huge part of that. And it feels to me, and I'm just going to throw this out there, and I know I'm going to get some flack on this one, but I don't care. It feels to me that people are looking for, you know, that pat on the back, that psychological pat down to kind of thing and say, you're doing a great job. You're working hard. We appreciate you. That's not the customer problem. That's a management problem. Get your manager to do that. Customer don't need to do that. Customers are paying for a service. Thank you very much. Delivered the service. Off you go. It brings back the how much growing up we need to do in the localization industry, to be honest. And I hate to be saying this, but I do feel like we have a lot of growing up to do.
Truth hurts and credit when it's due. I've had business reviews with my vendors every quarter and it was a balanced approach. We celebrated the wins. We called out the wins line by line, but we also focused on the areas that required improvement. So I think this is where the opportunity is. Mental toughness is needed in this business, especially in an AI-charged environment.
Which brings me to, you know, you led two completely different environments. Like, one question would be is, you know, when you look at Harley-Davidson, one of the brands that you were involved in, that's a very fundamental brand. Like, it is, you can't monkey around this. You have to get the brand correctly. And if you don't get the brand correctly, like, its identity, its attitude, its, you know, taking all this and encapsulating it in any language around the world, it's pretty challenging because, you know, what we think of as an attitude and an identity in one country may not be the same in another country. It has to be relatable. And then you go to Zendesk, where deep into AI-powered content operations and, you know, just pushing content, I think, it's different than the identity and attitude foundation of translation or localization in Harley-Davidson. There's a huge shift there. How did you manage that?
Change management, lots of Lebanese coffee for sure, mental toughness. But no, you bring up very good points, Robin. Well, at Harley, as I mentioned earlier, we had to think through the vendor structure. I was very unorthodox in the way I set up the vendor network because of the type of the content. So you would engage the large players, the known players for technical content, where you have an owner's manual for 700 pages. It's pretty much paint by number. You set up the system, the language is technical, it's set up, you launch it across 45, 50, 60 languages, up to 70 languages. But then you get to marketing. Harley-Davidson is not a global brand. It's an icon going global. It is the only brand in the world that gets tattooed on an arm. Very unapologetic.
You know, one of the questions I had in here, and I was going to ask you, but I didn't dare ask you yet, is do you translate the tattoos? Because I've seen it.
If they're appropriate, a lot of them aren't.
And I've seen some of these tattoos, like there's words in there, like it's descriptive.
Yes, absolutely. Graphic too. But so English wasn't even English. For example, a campaign that tells you to dress up the dresser. The dresser is the touring bike, and you can dress it up, customize it, and you can dress it down. So my entire transcreation approach was totally different. I engaged niche agencies, marketing agencies for transcreation, and the in-country reviewers, we went on a mission to hire riders who are bloggers as in-country reviewers, because they lived the brand. They knew how to tell the story and share their adventures online. So they're the best in-country reviewers. And the transcreation budget was a lot larger than the compliance budget, believe it or not, just because of the need to maintain brand heritage and brand prestige across so many markets. And in many cases, we didn't even translate because it wouldn't do it justice. We would just keep it in English, the headline or the positioning. Now, when we moved to Zendesk, the difference was huge because you had short form content. It was punchy. It was edgy content, next gen, young, but it was also short form and required a level of creativity. So the setup was different in terms of, okay, we only have a quarter to get this right. You've got to have bias towards time. And the agencies working are not your standard SaaS agencies or localization agencies supporting the Magnificent Seven. We needed niche type of agencies who understood what the next generation felt when they wanted to work in a CRM. So the entire strategy was different, and it was an amazing learning experience for me. Totally different. Two different worlds for sure. But I go back to say that the leadership standards remained the same. They got me through both.
Now, one of the questions, like when people are listening, you know, you've done obviously localization for many markets. And, you know, I got a number here that says about 150 markets you were involved in over your career. Is there such thing? And I know some people out there on the buyer side, they may have that thinking because I've talked to some of them and they do have that thinking. Is there's a difference between, you know, full treatment localization and good enough translation. And is there such thing, A, in your mind? And B, how do you decide?
Anything that is customer facing cannot be good enough. The ultimate goal in localization is to reach, engage, and connect with your audience. On the technical side, it's a compliance issue. If something goes wrong, if you mislocalize a torque, then it's a multi-million dollar lawsuit. So no shortcuts there. Some people rely, oh, it's a 700-page manual. Nobody's going to read all of it. You would be surprised. So no shortcuts whatsoever, ever. Campaigns, marketing campaigns, we all know the stories about power brands and passion brands that embarrass themselves in public and localization.
Yeah, I've seen a few.
So we all know the examples. So my approach or my strategy is that anything that is customer facing has to be published grade. No shortcuts whatsoever. Now, internally, if you have an intranet and you want to make it available for various company employees, then yes, you can add a plugin to the page. I'm not going to name some companies here, but we know who they are. You can add a plugin to your intranet, or the internal legal team has a 200-page contract that they need to summarize. Okay, well, they need the draft translation. We can make that available. But I remain very orthodox when it comes to publish great content and customer-facing content. No shortcuts there whatsoever.
No, this is a very good distinction, because if you're you can't use a broad brush stroke in those determinations. You got to look on a case by case basis and figure out which one can be treated in different processes, basically, and which one do you apply good enough, or which one do you give it a full treatment. And where people get it wrong is when they get lazy. They don't take the time to actually sit down and distinctly look at their content in a specific way and try to make a judgment call on this one. And may not be a judgment call of one individual. It could be a collective decision that the team has to do internally on some of these things. Because what I view as good enough may not be the same for others, or maybe I may be missing something. You don't want to get into lawsuits. That's the last thing anybody wants to do.
I had to fly to Canada, to Quebec.
You did? Okay. Build 96,
during
I'm assuming.
My time at Harley. To deal with a situation where the language police walked into a couple of dealerships and found the labels on the helmets and the gloves mistranslated into French Canadian, and some translations were missing. It wasn't a simple situation of, hey, you have until X date to localize and to launch. They shut down the dealerships and confiscated all of the products. I still have photos of the suspension sign on the dealership door and all of the products confiscated. So the world out there is brutal, and anything that has to do with compliance and customer-facing data needs to be treated with an utmost responsibility.
You know, you bring a the good point here is that we go from times, and you know, I've been here long enough in this industry to know that, where a product manufacturing in the US would say things like, I'm talking about 30 years ago, mm-hmm. If you don't speak English, you can't buy our product. And I've heard this thrown at me many times. And though to go to a place today where you don't have it translated correctly, basically take translation seriously. That's the message. If you don't take it seriously, it's going to impact your entire operation. It's not an afterthought. It's core Absolutely. Part of your operation. It's core part of your business plan. Now, from your work at Locverse, so what I hear always, and what I hear from the localization leaders, they all want to be part or seat at the strategy level when the customers are talking about strategy, when they're deciding their business strategy, and localization is part of that business strategy. Basically, the message, I want to be part of the business strategy as a localization industry. And most of them never achieve that. Like, they're not even at the table. And so you're on the inside. What does localization keep getting treated as a cost center versus as a strategic initiative that we need to be part of as a business? So everybody treats localization as a commodity. Mm-hmm. For the most part. I mean, the industry is trying to change that. I think it's too late, because we were down the road of commoditization to a point right now. I don't know how we're going to get up that uphill battle, but we're trying, and everybody is trying to put their 2 cents in there. But what is it that we're getting wrong in order for us to move away from that cost center to a strategic positioning?
Now, there are many factors that come into play. What people don't realize is that when you're on the buyer side, reorgs happen very often. Overnight, you can find yourself under a new department with a new leader and a completely different set of priorities. That means you always have to be ready to explain the value of localization and business terms and have a seat at the table. Now, I was able to secure multi-million dollar budgets consistently because I studied my leaders. I understood their priorities, their pressures, and what success looked like for them. I never led with localization terminology or internal metrics, as I mentioned earlier. Now, but when these reorgs happen, you're going to have to be ready to explain why you need a seat at the table, not why localization is important. That ship sailed. People understand that part of the GTM strategy, we need localization. Wherever it sits or it lands, it doesn't matter. At this point, you want to understand who your leaders are, what is important to them, and why localization needs a seat at the table. So for example, if the minute you sit with the compliance team and you lead with some examples, you have to have some bold statements to begin with. At Harley-Davidson, for example, without localization, bikes don't ship. Bikes don't ship has nothing to do with localization. It has to do with finance, compliance, and the sales team turning in their seats because the competition is already shipping. So you're actually talking to the problem that will impact the entire organization. That statement is disguised as localization, but it touches finance because it's loss of sales. It touches compliance because you're looking at fines. So they woke up in that meeting. And then the salespeople, are you telling me that the competition is already shipping, same dealerships, same markets, and we're not? So let's invest on localization. When you lead with that narrative, and that requires a specific understanding of your audience and what matters to them, they're going to listen and they're going to think of bringing you upstream in the process to address any gaps or any blind spots that may or may not realize while developing content or even considering to enter a new market. With marketing, it's the same thing. Sometimes you have to work by elimination. Some people come to you, you're going to have leaders come to you and say, well, why are we investing so much money on Bahasa? And why are you considering it as a tier one market? Everybody speaks good English there. And you, if you have the opportunity to do so, you could say, okay, we're going to pause localization for a couple of months and watch the traffic to the website drop. Take that data and show the leadership after 2 months. Now, it's a tall order. Sometimes you don't have the authority to do so. But again, when you understand what matters to that person or to that leader and tie your narrative to it, then you're no longer addressing localization. You are bringing to the table the risks that will impact the entire GTM strategy. So that would be my recommendation. I ran with this approach throughout my career. It worked very well for me. I trained my vendor to think this way during business reviews. Do not show up with a generic operations update. Tell me the business story. You're going to meet with my stakeholders, connect your work to the outcome. And also I trained and coached my team members to think the same way.
Now, one of the things that the localization industry has been trying to do is outcome-based translation or localization, meaning what is the outcome to the business if we do localization, websites, etc. Because everything that we put out there, there's two categories for it. There's commercial category, meaning I have to have a business reason for doing it, or there's compliance issue, as you mentioned in Quebec, for instance. The compliance part is a checkbox, and you need to do that. And if you don't, obviously there's many other things that goes along with that. You get sued, you don't ship your product, the list goes on. The other part where you are trying to convince the market to buy from you, that has to be a very well-oiled machine in terms of localization. We have to prove to the customer that whatever you've spent money on in the localization world has produced some outcome, some good business outcome for you. We've converted more visitors to your website. The shopping cart has been emptied by completing the purchases. All that stuff needs to be quantifiable. And I've heard a lot of this conversation in the localization industry, but nobody was actually able to put it together in a tangible way. We talk about it. We give some sort of rudimentary examples of how outcomes supposed to work, but nobody was able to, here is a report. I'm reporting on, you've done a, two-page translation. I'm just using that as a silly example. And we put it on your website. It actually converted more visitors from this specific language. And here's the engagement level that was resulted in that. That is missing. The connection between what I've translated and what I was able to achieve as a business, that connection, that bridge is in my opinion, still missing, unless somebody has figured it out in the past 24 hours. There are several attempts on this one, and people are doing various versions of it, but a complete picture from end to end, it's missing, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, it's true. It is missing, and it also depends on the company you're working with. If you have the luxury of data and KPIs, you can work with your stakeholders and ask to have access to the traffic to the website or to the email click-through or the in-product messaging and translate that data or tie them directly to localization results. In many cases, localization managers and teams do not have access to this data, or there's a level of reservation. The other teams do not want to share that data. My approach would be try to explain to them why you're asking for this data, because it's going to make them look good. And also invite them to a presentation, like co-plan, co-present with other stakeholders and other team members about the benefits of localization and how you achieved a certain result on a campaign together. How you worked with the compliance team in Canada together to eliminate fines and avoid any problems. Starting with a relationship or type of an building engagement and partnership, be an ally with counterparts around the organization to help them make them look good will help you tremendously. Now, sometimes it's not an option either. We have to be fair about this. What worked well for me was competitive benchmarking. Nothing gets under the leadership skin
more than telling what the competitors are doing.
Yes. So, and you can get this data. You can certainly get this data through environmental scans, hiring an agency, buying some reports. Most localization managers have some excess budget that they need to spend before the end of the quarter. Throw them on benchmarking, competitive benchmarking. Because when you're armed with this data and go back to your peers, vertically or horizontally, and share with them this data, you are actually not asking for permission. You are presenting them with intel and data that will help you get an edge or help the other team get an edge. It's not easy, Robin. And each company is unique with its setup, with the politics, with the culture. For sure. You really need to spend at least 3 to 4 months understanding the sphere of influence, the pain points, what clicks and what doesn't click, the culture, and then go from there.
Yeah. And you know, I'm a fractional CRO and I help companies figure this out, to be honest with you. And one of the biggest... My biggest pet peeve is when I see a book of business, you know, 100 accounts under one individual in Harley Davidson under one sales rep. And Harley Davidson, as an example, would be one line item in 100 other accounts. Now, what we're talking about here is deep understanding of these customers. And I can tell you without a doubt that there is no human being out there that's going to be able to understand 100 customers at the same level. What they are doing is understanding the top 10 customers out of a list of 100. And if, you know, Harley Davidson happened to be part of the top 10, fine. If they are not, then they're not dedicating enough time to understand this particular customer. It's just amount of resources you are going to designate. And this industry, I mean, you know that, this industry is not famous for sales and marketing. I mean, let's put it this way. This industry does the poorest job of any industry on sales and marketing. They're afraid of investing in sales. They're afraid of investing in marketing.
Especially in marketing.
Harnessing their messages. I'm sorry, I'm doing some self-criticism here. I'm part of the industry. I'm not doing this to offend anybody, but we suck at sales and marketing. And I'm here to fix that. I told everybody, I said, we know how to fix this. It's not a huge issue. All you need is to put the right formula in place, put the right emphasis in place, or put the right, I want to say, focus in place on what you need to do and how you want to do it. I'm recalled with this anecdote years ago. I was working in the telecom sector. And this is a long time ago now. I can talk about it. One of the companies no longer around. I can mention these companies. So Nortel had an account in Canada and had that account for a long time because it's Canadian to Canadian company. And Cisco wanted to win that account. I'm not mentioning that account because I know these people. So, and they did what they did and talk about getting to know your customer. This is the point that you're trying to make. They hired an account rep. They told them, okay, we don't own that account. It's with somebody else. It's a large account. But what we want you to do is do a deep dive into this account. You're not here. We're not putting you here to sell anything at this point. Your goals is to get to know the customer. Who are these customers? You know, who are the influencers? You know, and they, you know, I use Miller Hyman. So they everything from the financial to the technical decision maker to anybody who can really impact the decision. We want to map out this customer. To a point, we want you to understand, what are they like for food? If you take them out for lunch or something, you know, what's their, these are the things that they're reporting on. And why did they, and they gave this individual 3 years, not just 6 months, 3 years to map out this customer, understand the DNA of the customer, not persona, personally, but as a company, and then come back and put a plan together. Now I've got enough intelligence on this customer. I want to put a plan back. They ended up winning the customer, by the way. Now, amazing. When you approach it from the outside in as a localization industry, as you mentioned earlier in the conversation, oh, we do translation. We have, you know, good translators in local market. Who doesn't? Come on, give me a break. This is not the pitch.
That's table stakes.
Now, you've done this. I'm just going to move a little bit on AI here. We talk a little about, I was just on a call earlier. We talk a little about the hidden problems with AI-generated content. And you made a video on this one, which I told you I really loved it. For the listener who has not seen it, what is the hidden problem and why is everyone missing it, if you don't mind, in your opinion?
Yeah, no, that is an excellent question, Robin, and thanks for watching the video. The value of AI is in daily work is undeniable, okay? I think that ship sailed. The problem starts when people cannot distinguish between what should be automated and what should remain under human control. In marketing, for example, I would not rely on AI for true ideation or concepting. AI is pulling from content that is already exist. It can help shape, scale, and adapt ideas, but is not where original positioning should begin. And this is the mistake that is happening today. If your positioning, headline, value prop, and message strategy are clear, then AI can incredibly be useful. It can help you scale short-form content, long-form content, and improve consistency and support brand integrity across all market. The same applies to sales outreach. If you let AI write and send everything without human judgment, and the same prospect receives three nearly identical automated emails in 1 week, you are not building trust. You are creating noise. You are actually eroding trust.
That's called hope and pray.
Right? I mean, the companies and professionals that will stand out are the ones using AI intelligently. They will automate the right task while still owning ideation, initiation, judgment, and trust in their own voice. In every single capacity, from, I don't know, localization engineer to radiologist, you have three major steps: ideation, execution, validation. That middle piece can be automated. Ideation, you need to own it. Otherwise, you're just leveraging what's on the internet. I think this clarity is not there yet in our business. And it has to do with many factors. Pressure from the C-suite. The market is moving very fast. We moved from soon enough to real time. People don't have time to pause and think and get clarity. And in the next few months, that's going to be the difference. Who has clarity on how to leverage AI to its fullest potential without impacting authenticity?
Now, the question with AI, and we talk about it quite often, is what is our defensible zone? What are we going to keep as a human? And you mentioned earlier ideation, for instance, but what is our defensible zone? And every job in the language industry has a specific defensible zone that needs to keep with the human. And there are some aspects where automation is the only hope and only solution. And then once we understand what that is, and for people to say, we put AI, but we're not seeing any benefit of it. I see this, and I know you deployed AI at scale in the past, and I'd love to dig into that from an operational perspective. And because that is what everybody is struggling with right now. I mean, I'm talking about the small to medium businesses. You know, our industry is 80-20, right? So 80% of the revenue in our industry comes from the top 20 companies. And there is 19,000 companies below that that has, you know, $20 million and below in revenue. And they're still trying to figure things out. I mean, I see it till today. We gave access to, you know, ChatGPT for our staff, but we're not seeing benefits of it. Well, that's not how you deploy AI. I mean, this is how you order Netflix.
Exactly.
That's not how you deploy AI. I'm sorry, but trying to put things in perspective for people, buying licenses for your staff for ChatGPT is not how you deploy AI. Can you speak to your experiences how did you deploy AI for content operation?
Certainly. So the first time we deployed AI was right around COVID. It took industries by storm, and then you didn't really have a choice. The Zendesk decided to engage a certain LLM, and you had no option but to use it. Now, luckily, we had a strong foundation, and AI came to accelerate it. So by the time people were putting meetings on the calendar and trying to figure out how to leverage AI in their own space, we have already rolled out 4 AI use cases to automate some daily activities that alleviated some of the daily grind from the team. A lot of project management activities that were draining the team, we were able to automate them. And also QA checks, for example, on less risky content. So I would say if you have a strong foundation and in terms of content workflow, you are able to collapse it using AI because you have clarity on your workflow. But if you do not have clarity on your workflow, if your workflow is already problematic, adding AI to it will muddy the water. You want to start by defining what you can own in terms of ideation, thought leadership with the client, setting up a project, and then the areas that are draining your team daily and that you could automate. They're repetitive tasks that you literally do not need to have control over. And that will bring you clarity and also validation. You can certainly deploy QA checks using AI, follow a certain algorithm, but the human output, especially for marketing content, you still need the second set of eyes to solidify this last mile of hyper-local content prior to launch. So I would say we were fortunate because we had a strong foundation and AI came to accelerate it. But other teams struggled because the workflow and the foundation were not there. The other area where we saw a major opportunity was orchestration. Unfortunately, vendors position TMS. Now we're still using the word TMS, which blows my mind. And it's no longer the brain. It is an orchestration layer in the future. It has to be packaged and presented as your next-gen migration tool that will help you orchestrate and integrate with MarTech stack, with your LMS, with your CMS, and so forth and so on. That's the opportunity that we also found and seized at Zendesk because we were able to expedite orchestration and integration across MarTech and the CMS because of AI. So again, it's a case-by-case situation. My recommendation would be solidify your foundation first before integrating or adding AI to it. Otherwise, you're going to be muddying the water.
And for the audience, what Wadaa is talking about here is that, as you've heard me talk about in the previous couple of episodes, is if you have to analyze your internal processes. You cannot overlay technology on top of a broken process. If your processes are not fitting the new technology that you're going to be bringing in, that's not going to help you. It's going to accelerate or exaggerate the problem that you originally have. So make sure we go through this correctly by scanning what you're doing right now, applying it to each customer of yours, and see where are these processes are good and which part maybe we don't need anymore because technology is affording you new possibility. And you probably have some steps in the process that you probably don't need right now. The second thing is, and I've talked about it before, and I'm going to leave you with this tagline, TMS is with content goes to die. And I've said that before, and I continue saying it. This static data, nobody wants that. Activated data, actioned data, this is where you are going to make a difference. And how do we activate the data? How do we make action of that specific data that we've collected? And trust me, the transition industry sits on treasure trove of good data. You've collected these corpuses over the years, many, many years, how long you guys have been on operation out there. Now, you take that data and you action it using models. You model it through AI or various other agentic applications that you are going to develop in the future. Now you're activating it. Now you're putting it into practice. You're not just doing query. My background is data. So I was a DBA for a large insurance company before. I know how this works. I was one of the first one that deployed DB2 and SQL on a mainframe. So I know how this works. Instead of querying the data, now we don't need to query it. We can just overlay an application on top of it. And that is always engaging in every input and output that we're putting onto that top of that data. So those are very, very important things for people to think about as we are approaching the new initiatives that we're going to be deploying. If you haven't done that already, I also talk about this evolve or dissolve. If you are not evolving, that means you're dissolving, and then you're probably talking to somebody about buying your company. However, if you want to, if you're insisting on continuing on going into the future, you got to look about new processes and how do we bring value to our customers out there. Did I capture that?
Very well said.
Absolutely. Now, and the second thing is that this is the segment where I've been waiting for. A lot of people prospect out there, right? So from the localization industry, you've seen many emails land in your inbox and, you know, we are the best and, you know, we want to be a partner, not a vendor. I've heard this catchphrase many times. It's just sort of like it rolls my eyes when I say that, I can't believe I'm saying this. And my audience are selling perhaps, you know, to customers such as you were at various companies. Be honest with them, if you don't mind. Which vendor pitch, for instance, landed in your inbox and you said, wow, this is crap. I don't want to do anything with it. I just want to delete it. And which one grabbed your attention and why did you do that?
Okay. I have to be very careful with this one. Okay. Let me just say this. I've had the pleasure of working and onboarding dozens of LSPs and solution vendors of all shapes and sizes. Okay. And as I said, I was a little bit unorthodox in my approach. It wasn't always localization agencies. I hired riders and I had to onboard them in a certain system. But the vendors who stood out were the ones who did their homework on us as a company and on me as a leader. They understood the company, the team's persona, the personality, the business pressures, and the likely pain points before even engaging in an email or an RFP response. What many vendors do not realize is that clients compile RFP answers side by side. Okay, let's talk about the RFP a little bit, because that's a pain point, and I support a lot of my clients with it. I cannot tell you, Robin, how many times I read the exact same paragraph or sentence from 5 or 6 different vendors side by side. Everyone says
they copy each other.
Probably. I don't know. Now with AI, it's even scarier.
It's an open book test. It's an open book test.
Literally, like translators, native speakers reside in their country of origin. The TMS includes glossary and terminology features. That is not differentiation, folks. That is table stakes. The vendors who told the story specific to my business or line of work led with data, not just statements without substance, were the ones who made the shortlist. They were the ones I onboarded, trusted, and in some cases brought with me from Xerox to Harley Davidson to Zendesk. But I also want to stress that it's often more about the people than the vendor brand. When you work well with a certain account manager or a delivery team, when there's chemistry, responsiveness, and trust, that becomes the real differentiator. So my advice to vendors is simple. Keep your best people happy. They are your greatest asset. Technology will evolve and it can be replaced or replicated. Trust and rapport are much harder to build and much easier to lose.
100%. Now, in your career, I'm assuming you've walked away from vendors without naming anybody. What really makes a client leave? Because I suspect, you know, throughout this conversation, we never touched price. I suspect it's almost never price, but the vendors have it in their mind. They found a cheaper, you know, this is the excuse that I hear all the time. Oh, they found a cheaper vendor. Is it truly the price? I don't think so. I don't believe so. I think there are other factors that makes a customer leave a vendor.
Certainly. Now, pricing is important. If an agency comes across as overly expensive, you're going to get a lot of heat from procurement because the hiring manager is not the only one making a decision on the client side. There are a lot of moving parts and procurement is always the first line of defense. They're going to look at the numbers and you're going to be questioned. If you're able to build the case about the vendor and the long-term compounding effect, then okay, you're in good hands. But yeah, pricing is not the number one factor. I would say, well, mistakes happen. Sometimes, but if the same mistake is repeated over and over and over again, and you're getting a lot of heat from stakeholders around the organization regarding a vendor, and this vendor, instead of listening, is becoming defensive, then it's a problem and you have to move on from them. I've had a situation with a vendor where we gave them a second chance, a third chance, went through probably 3 different teams just to make things work because it's easier to work it out with a vendor than offboarding and onboarding a new vendor. So I was very patient with some vendors, but they just couldn't cut it or couldn't break through the mindset of defensiveness. It's more of a pointing finger. No, we did this right. The team doesn't like us. The team doesn't want to work with us. And when you get into that slippery slope, you've got to pull the plug and move forward. Otherwise, it's a problem. So I would say it all falls under behavior and chemistry and relationship. Sure. Problems happen. But if a vendor takes
an
extra step and handles them and work with us and sometimes calls us out and say, hey, we can fix this, but you also need to change this on the client side from your end to make that work, then yes, I'll meet you halfway. But the defensiveness mentality, the lack of accountability and ownership, the lack of responsiveness lead to parting company, unfortunately.
Now, the flip side of that conversation is when a vendor made you look brilliant in front of your executives, what did they do right?
Well, they delivered or they overachieved. I think there's a mentality around, and you find that in the RFP too, the turnaround times are ridiculous. Even in the age of AI, vendors are still leveraging the previous turnaround time for quality checks.
Well, and I still hear a bunch of 2,000 words a day. I just don't get to believe it.
To me, this is mind-blowing. Delivering is the expectation. Overachieving is what makes a vendor stand out. And when they did, we actually brought them during business reviews and had them present to the leadership and introduce them to the wider team. Because the vendor is an extension of your team. They make you look good. And to the vendor, vendors need to understand that a client is their inside sales manager. If they do good, they're going to be able to expand internally because the localization manager on the buyer side is happy. You're making them look good. So some vendors work very well and seize that opportunities, and others go around the loc manager to other departments trying to sell their product. It backfires. Your single point of contact and your relationship is with this person. Build it, make them look good. They're your inside sales manager. They're going to make you expand within the organization.
And you become a champion for this individual, won't you?
Exactly. You're their champion. You're their sponsor. And during the RFP process that's going to be renewed, they're going to have your back.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. Now, you advise technology vendors currently in your practice. And you have exposure from a dual lens almost for what works and what doesn't work. And you are on the client side. You're on the vendor side as well. So what is the first thing you ask or you advise on how the fix on how they sell? Like, what are the things that they probably need to fix in how they sell?
Well,
long list.
The list is quite long, and it depends on the challenges with vendors. Some vendors are getting leads, but they're not converting. That's also another problem. But you have to do not show up with a generic operations update or a generic message when you are addressing a client. Now, a lot of vendors are under pressure now. SDRs inside the company, they have a long list of clients that they need to reach, and they're going to leverage, I don't know, Eloqua or Apollo to automate email messages and text messages and blast that email. Clients pick up on an automated message. And if you're trying to build confidence and rapport and establish a relationship, it has to be with your own voice. That is the biggest disservice you could do to yourself as a professional or as a company, is to kick off a relationship using an automated voice, or even worse, no voice at all. So try to be mindful when you reach out on LinkedIn or using Sales Navigator or Apollo or Eloqua. Try to be mindful and intentional with your message, so people give you a second chance or are even interested in having a conversation. Being pushy in the approach doesn't help either. Reading the room, understanding that, okay, this client is not ready now for an RFP. Maybe you want to maintain a relationship with them, so when the time comes, you are top of mind. But if you're going to repel them with nonstop messages, then it's going to be a problem. Also, try not to sell or polish something that is already available on the market across the board. You really need a differentiator. Why do I want to work with you, or why do I want to jump on a call with you? What is the differentiator? What is the distinctive thing that you do that other agencies are not doing right now? And then I'm interested in having a conversation, even if I'm not ready to onboard you as a vendor yet.
Absolutely. Now, I want to thank you so much for this. I really appreciate it. I just have, you know, maybe one short question and then we'll wrap it up. It's basically I just want to get your opinion on and call it rapid fire. So one word client used to describe a great vendor.
Best friend at work. That's more than one word. Sorry.
That's all right. Another one. Most underrated market in the world right now.
I would say UAE.
And in your opinion, AI and localization, overhyped, underhyped, or both?
Underhyped.
And the last one, the best business advice you ever received.
I had the opportunity to work with great mentors. The best business advice is give people what they need, not what they want.
Appreciate that. And lastly is, where could people find you and how do they get a hold of you if they're interested after this conversation to reach out?
People can find me on LinkedIn. I'm quite active there. There's always something to say in our industry, and I try to be intentional. And I also, I'm available through my website, www.thelogverse.com.
I really appreciate it, and thank you for your time with me. I really enjoyed this conversation, to be honest with you. I had fun with it.
Me too. I love it. This is like a morning ride on a Friday. I love it.
I really appreciate it. Thank you, Wada. This is exactly the conversation I was hoping to do today. And then we did it together. We recorded the episode together. And I want to thank the audience for joining us on the journey of listening into this conversation. If you are coming on our YouTube channel, thanks for watching us. If you are on the audio channels, thanks for listening in. And if you guys hop on to the robinayoub.blog website, where I archive these conversations in a consumable form, thanks for reading the blog. I really appreciate it. I see the stats going up. I guess you guys prefer to read sometimes instead of listening into an hour conversation. Thank you so much for doing that. I really appreciate it. And I want to thank our guest speaker today, Wada Fahed from The Logverse. And I really appreciate you being with me. And I want to wish you all the best, all the luck in the world, and all the success in the world. Be healthy and safe.
Thank you, Robin. The pleasure was mine.
Thanks, everybody, and I'll see you at the next episode. This is Robin Ayoub, and signing off. Appreciate it.